Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Show. My name is Tom Douglas. I am a chef here in Seattle area, including our Serious Takeout out in Ballard at 52nd 40th Northwest, Serious Pie downtown, and my conglomeration of three of our old joints into one down at the north end of the Pike Place Market area, the Seatown, Rub Shack, and Edda's Combo. Chef, we've been working really hard on trying to come up with a combo name for those three because we're going to reopen the group as one. I've been fighting with my team. They all want Edda's. I want Seatown, and we can't. I got outvoted like 10-1. So maybe today, Oof. Chef, you could come on in my defense Oof. And help us name what our new name is going to be for all three joints. What else do I have going on? I have a friend over there in Madison Valley sitting upstairs in his home office with his chapeau on and his microphone. And what's going on, Chefy? Nice to see you.
Thierry Roturo, the chef in a hat here in Madison Valley. Like I said, it's sunny and 71 degrees, so I might want to calm down to Madison Valley. What's going on? Nothing. We're running Luke on the to-go section. We're starting to build up some nice covering for the patio outside. So in a couple of weeks, we'll open that. We'll open the inside after all our people are vaccinated. And we just want the team to be safe as much as possible. Not that it's a 100% foolproof thing, yeah, but it's no actually kidding. Very much helping. We'll do that. We'll follow that trend. And I know later on we're going to talk about sauce for halibut. But this week, in our menu box, we're featuring halibut dinner. And it's been very, very popular. Thank you to all of you who are buying those boxes. And we have a few more left until the end of the weekend. And we'll see. Maybe we'll do it again next week. Who knows?
Maybe so.
Easter is right around the corner, though.
It is. Easter is happening fast. Halibut is such a popular fish. We have it three ways down at Seatown right now. And it is outselling everything else on the menu by double. It's just it's amazing how much people look forward to fresh halibut season and all the different, you know, we have it fried, we have it, you know, as fish and chips, we have it as fish tacos, and we have it a fish sandwich, and then we have a halibut fillet. We have it every way you could possibly want it. It's been fun.
Delicious.
Yeah, it's been fun to have something new. It really is the first sign of spring, that halibut season starting, isn't it?
Like, I know.
And pretty soon asparagus will follow right behind it, and spring peas, and
morels. Ooh-hoo!
Yeah, it's time. It's been a long winter. We're going to talk about our fragrant and flavorful sauce, kind of the ketchup of China, hoisin sauce, and my favorite brand, the commercial brand. And then there's also easily ways to make it yourself, which is I don't think people really think about. Many people haven't even tried it in the first place, or at least they don't know that they've tried it. If you've had a Peking duck bun, you know, at a Chinese restaurant where you've had Peking duck, what they serve with the little pancakes and scallions is hoisin sauce. If you've had mushu pork at a Chinese restaurant, what they serve to go with those pancakes is hoisin sauce. And so it is virtually a ketchup, but it's just a different coming from a different angle. Halibut, yep, we're going to talk about that for a whole segment. Chef Annie Elmore is going to be here to talk about her favorite Cambodian treats for Cambodian New Year. One of our house chefs here at the Hot Stove Society, Bridget Charters, is going to be talking about making masa. She does these masa master classes here at the Hot Stove, and they're super fun. And I actually had to, she was sick one day, and I had to teach it. And I taught myself a bunch of things about masa just through her curriculum. It was fun to actually teach that class. First, let's talk about our taste of the week. Sir, you have an interesting taste. You held it up. And I thought from my vantage point on our Zoom that it was a yam or a sweet potato, and you say that it is not.
It is not. It is very similar in terms of look from the outside because it's got kind of like a reddish purplish skin. When you peel it, the number one thing you have to worry about is oxidation, which means that it will turn gray very fast, pretty fast, like a radish kind of idea. So you have to put some acid on it, usually lemon. The flavor and the texture is the one of a cut between a pear. There's a little pear. There's a little ginger. There's a little light nuttiness. It's definitely my first introduction to it was yesterday. I made a salad with it. You won't believe when I tell you what I did with it. Kathy wanted a Waldorf salad. And I was like, oh, come on. So I made homemade mayonnaise mixed with sour cream to make the dressing, toasted spicy walnuts. The this is called, by the way, yacon. So it's like Y-U-C-O-N, and it's from South America originally. even though now in the last 15, 20 years, it's picked up a lot in Poland and other places in the world to be cultivated and very prolific. So it's a beautiful vegetable. I recommend looking for it. And if you can taste it, it's got a sweetness to it. And the sugar that's in there is not like a sweet potato. It's a sugar that your body won't digest. So it will go through you without making any bad impact for your health.
Where did you buy it?
I did not buy it. I actually have my manager at Luc Tram, who's of Vietnamese descendants, as she's part of a garden, what do you call that, like a cooperative garden. And they grew a plant or two of that, and she brought me some because she was curious. She loved it, and she gave me some and to try. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is new discovery. I'm definitely using that vegetable. Awesome for salads and for side garnish. I mean, I can use that in crudos. I can use that in so many different things. Very delicious. I recommend it. Definitely, like we were talking earlier, like the yucca as a texture, as a color, but not much flavor when it's left with it. This is definitely flavorful, delicious, and it's got all kind of different beautiful sides. So very, very cool. I recommend it. Yucon.
Y-U-C-O-N.
C-O-N. Okay. It's also called the, I believe it's called the apple of the earth in Peru and in, you know, different places where it's used, Chile, Argentina. You know, so it's a very popular vegetable or tuber that's being used in South America. And like I said, it's spreading over the world. So.
And if you want to find it, my guess is Wajamaya has it, but I would think also maybe some South American groceries. I'm not sure which one I would head to for that. But maybe one of our listeners, maybe Pike Place. Maybe one of our listeners could tell us where they have found this Yukon, Y-U-C-O-N, and we could all get a chance to try it. My taste of the week is going to be really quick. I was going through, you know, I like to, as we start this new farm season, I like to make sure that I use up everything of the old farm season. So I went through my freezer. I had a bunch of ham, so I wanted to make ham soup. So I went through my freezer and picked out all the odds and ends I had left, the beans, the peas, the corn. I had a quart of pumpkin left. I have a couple of pints of tomato sauce left. And I put it all together and made ham soup. And I got to tell you, Chef, I love that kitchen sink kind of cooking. It was so good. I had some my Asian duck stock that I've finished up, some reduced chicken stock. Anything, any little bits and pieces that I had left from the harvest, I put in there into that soup, and I made myself 10 pints of ham soup, and it is so delicious. All right, coming up, it's time for a halibut. It's a big halibut season. Let's talk about how to cook it, where to find it, and what to look for when you're looking for fresh halibut. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society. We're right back in your kitchen. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotureau, the chef in hat.
And it's halibut season, and we're going to talk about where to buy it, what to look for when you buy it, and maybe a few different ways to cook it once you do get it. It's a very versatile fish. The one thing I would say about halibut, Chef, and is that it's just super lean. You have to be very careful that either you don't overcook it, which is hard to do, even sometimes when it's medium rare. It starts to dry out a little bit. Certainly medium, it starts to dry out a little bit. But you also don't want to undercook it too much, because halibut is a bottom fish and is known to have parasites if you're not careful with it and you don't keep a good eye on it. So why don't you jump in first, Terry, and tell us what do you look for when you're in a fish market and you got the big sign saying fresh halibut's here, yahoo! There's it's $19.95 a pound, so it's not cheap, but it's also not crazy expensive like Copper River salmon or something of that nature. What's the first thing you look for when you look for halibut in the supermarket?
Well, first of all, if the head is on the fish, which is always a good idea for a fishmonger to keep the head on the fish so people can see if it's fresh.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen. You and I both know that.
Most of the time they remove the head, and for a good reason. The cheek on the halibut are absolutely delicious. It's another delicacy that comes out of that fish. But if you can find, I need a little firmness in my fillet. I don't want, when I put my finger through the gray skin of that halibut, usually it's on the gray side. If you put your finger in it and it goes straight in like a soft piece of cloth or whatever, if it goes straight in, It is definitely not as fresh as it should be.
Right.
I want a piece of halibut that has some firmness to it. So when I press on it, I want to have a little retention. I don't want it to be like going through.
Okay.
That's the number one thing I'm going to look for. Number two, I'm going to look around the color if the head is off where they have the ice. And I'm going to look at it and try to smell it, see if there is any, like, you know, if it feels like it's been there for 4 days or 5 days already in the open, you know, getting oxidized and not being as good and as fresh as it should be. Normally, in a good fishmonger, that stuff does not exist. It's usually a day or two old. And it's not old, it's just 1 or 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Your fillet is perfectly fine because it's covered on both sides by the skin and the bones and everything. So, and then two, I'm a big fan of, if you don't like or you're not feeling secure in cooking fish in your house in terms of you're not sure, you're afraid to overcook it or everything, I personally would recommend baking it. Baking it with something on top, like what we're doing in our box this week at Luke. Cover it with olive tapenade and like lemon confit and everything. Put a layer on top of that piece of halibut. Put the whole thing in the oven. 10, 15 minutes later, you get the perfectly cooked piece of halibut. You know, don't be afraid to take a knife when it's almost done. After 12 minutes, take a knife, make a little cut and see if it's cooked.
Or if put a thermometer in it. We talk about that all the time.
Thermometer, exactly.
Yeah, 120 degrees.
But, you know, some people don't have thermometer. If you have a knife, it's okay. It's not going to kill the fish. It's not going to hurt it. But you're going to have a much better piece of fish in the end. So just don't be shy. Put it on a sheet pan on a piece of aluminum foil in the oven, you know, and you've got that covering that will not allow it to dry. The problem with halibut, as Tom mentioned, it's not fatty. It's not, you know, there is very little play of fat in there. So, you know, if you put it in the oven just by itself like that, you have to know pretty much what you're doing. A little bit more, especially with high heat. So
I would say here, so I'm going to go back to two things. One is on when you're looking at it at your fish store, like Mutual Fish or places like that, it should be shiny and fresh. And then when you most people aren't going to buy a whole fillet like you and I do.
No.
But buy it from the collar down. You don't want to buy halibut tails, right? It's already a dry fish. You don't want to buy the tail where it's dry and stringy. Right. So that's buy it from the neck of the fish down. That's called the collar of the fish, right before the head. And then so when you get your fillet, make sure you point to that. I'd like to from that side of the fish, right? Because you're going to want to get rid of the tails first, because they know that, you know, they have to sell the whole fish to be profitable, but not everyone understands the best part of the fish. So be smart out there. Secondly, Chef, I said you should use a thermometer, and you said use a knife. I'm just going to disagree with you. A digital thermometer is $15 max. They are an incalculable tool in the kitchen to make you a better cook.
Absolutely.
They just tell you what's happening in that filet. I don't care if it's a filet mignon or a filet halibut. That you want to know for sure what's happening in the middle of that fish. And so a digital thermometer takes, 2 seconds to read?
Yep.
And if it's at 120 to 125 for halibut, you're done.
Yep.
Pull it out. It'll go to 130 on its own. And it'll continue to cook a little bit. So I would really strongly recommend that everyone has a digital thermometer. And the reason I say digital is they're instant read compared to the old-fashioned ones that have the dial and you have to wait to see. You watch it go climb up to 100 degrees, 105, 108. You know, it's like next thing you know, your oven's cold, and you it's really nonsense. So that's just really important. Okay, so other ways. You say bake it with maybe a tapenade. I know our friends out at the Ark restaurant. Remember the Ark over in Willapa,
yeah.
Nancy and Jamella?
Yeah, yeah.
They used to have a dish that they got famous for called halibut du chef. And that was a very popular way to explain things in the 80s on menus, right? It was like this kind of half French, half English as we transitioned into American cooking, which just wasn't really out there in the 50s, 60s, 70s, right? It started in the 70s, 80s. But halibut du chef, and they just put a big couple of tablespoons full of tartar sauce on top and baked it under the tartar sauce, which is mayonnaise, which is fat, right? So they got very well known for that dish, halibut du chef.
You could also do something like mushroom duxelle or something like this, chopped mushroom, you know, put that on top of your fish, and that would also do a great dish as well.
Earlier, I was saying that Seatown restaurant, halibut came out this week, and we've been making it every which way. The number one way that we say sell halibut right now at SeaTown is fish and chips. And yeah, it's not cheap. I think it's $25 for fish and chips instead of the North Pacific cod that we usually use. But people dig it. They really love it. And it's just the cod is $10 a pound. The halibut is $20 a pound. It has to be more expensive. And the second way they love it the most is in fish tacos. So I just, my pork rub in my line of spice rubs has a Southwest flavor. You know, that cumin, lots of mild chilies, a little bit of garlic, not much.
So a little bit of smokiness.
Yeah, a little bit of smokiness. And I just sprinkle that on the halibut, and I make my regular fish taco with the corn, you know, crispy corn shell, a little slaw, a little fish taco, and then a little avocado crema on top. And the fish is just seared really quick. It cooks in 30 seconds because it's small pieces, right? And it's seared really quick and with the pork rub on it. And, man, people go nuts for that. People love fish tacos, and they're such
delicious
finish. Yeah,
it's really delicious. I think it's a very – and also halibut makes a great pre-cooked fish. Then you shred into a salad.
You know, tell me about that.
Like if you make like a base like a Niçoise, except right now there is no tomato and there is no haricot vert. Mm-hmm. So right now it's not really the time. But you could do like a potato salad and add some greens into it, you know, some arugula, some other greens that
escarole,
you have in the garden.
Maybe.
Escarole, yeah, and a radicchio, and then chopped herbs, and mix the whole thing together, and then take your halibut that you've already pre-baked. You know, when you do fish, sometimes you have too much. You have some left over. Put it in the fridge, and the next day, you shred it into a salad.
I never do that.
Oh, yeah, with a little dressing right on top of that. It's delicious. Mm-hmm. I mean, why? Think about it. You would open a can of tuna just to put on top of your salad.
Absolutely.
This is fresh halibut you just cooked the night before. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not?
I might even, you know, if you have extra halibut, you might even cook some at the same time that you're cooking the night before, just
correct
in planning for that salad the next
exactly.
day.
Exactly. Yeah. And same thing with tartine. You could do a tartine, and under the same roof, you could take that meat, that halibut that's cooked in your refrigerator, put it in a bowl, take a fork, maybe a little homemade mayonnaise, crush the whole thing together, and put that on top of a tartine with some pickled vegetable right on top of that.
Uh-huh.
It would be so delicious.
You know what we call that in this country, I think, is when you devil it. You know how they
It's
like you have deviled salmon, deviled ham. You can do deviled halibut. And that's essentially adding kind of a mustardy mayonnaise with pickles. I think it's
almost
more
like
of a German,
kind of idea.
German
yeah.
technique, honestly.
Right. But. No, it's really delicious. It's a great way to use. I mean, I'm sure and certain that many people look at that fish that's in their refrigerator that was for dinner last night that was left over, and they look at it hoping 3 days are going to go by and then they will have the authorization to put in the garbage. You know, it's because they don't know what to do with it. I'm like, man, don't waste it. It's beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it's $20 a pound.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was going to say the difference between cod and halibut has a lot more waste than cod. That's why it costs more per pound. So anyway.
All right.
I just think it's a beautiful time of the year. Plus, there is that hope that spring is here, you know, a sunny day to these days and some fresh halibut. Oof.
Oof. That was great. We're going to take a little time out and visit with Chef Annie Elmore and celebrate the Cambodian New Year with some of her favorites. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Kitchen on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And Chef Terry, we're going to visit with our friend Annie Elmore, who is one of the chefs over here at the Hot Stove Society and also out at our kitchen in Ballard, the Series Takeout Kitchen. And we're going to ask her a bit. We've heard her talk on the show about Lunar New Year's and different her boxes that she sells through our kitchen out there in Ballard. But also, we don't know much about Annie. So, Annie, are you on our line right now?
I am.
Nice.
Good morning.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. How are you?
Fabulous.
Awesome. Annie, before we go down the road of Cambodian New Year, let's find out more about you, because our listeners want to know. They've heard from you a few times now, but I don't even really know your background and why we're having you on to talk about Cambodian food. What the heck do you know about it?
Wow, that's a loaded question. I am half Vietnamese, quarter Cambodian, and quarter Chinese. I was born in Cambodia and lived there till I was six. So I lived in Cambodia longer than I lived in Vietnam. But I was raised culturally both more Vietnamese, because we kind of had to erase our Cambodian side when we moved to Vietnam because, you know, racism and stuff like that. So I kind of forget about that side of me for a while, and I kind of want to revisit it again since I have a son, and I want him to really know his real mom. And, you know, it's okay to be more than just one race now, or one nationality. So I feel that I'm okay to talk more about that side of me nowadays.
And of course, you know, I always think about it in just the opposite way. To me, it's a celebration when you have this and that. I mean, I couldn't tell you how many things I got in me, but when you have this and that, you get to celebrate so many different cultures.
Totally.
Poor Chef Terry is only French. What he only gets to celebrate.
That's
so sad.
Yeah, but the good thing is I celebrate everybody else too.
Right, exactly.
Any excuse is good for a celebration.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your Cambodian side then. Cambodian New Year, and what you're going to make to celebrate, what's traditional, what maybe is your favorite, and what's your kid's favorite?
This will be my kid's first year to actually get to eat real food. I mean, before that, he was just drinking milk. We are going to go to street food, because that's what people are known for. You know, when they go to Cambodia or Thailand, people are always talking about the street food, you know, like night. But that's what I'm going to be doing most of it. So a lot of frying, a lot of grilling, a lot of food on a stick, you know, bugs and all sort of fun things that most of us like to eat. I'm kidding. No bugs, but that's what you mostly find, you know, spiders, grasshoppers, all those things that you can find around your house.
Uh-huh.
I'm kidding. No.
And he eats them. I like that.
Lots of protein.
Mm-hmm.
Cheap. But I am going to make this fried baguette. I don't know if a lot of people know about the Cambodian culture. We do have quite a bit of French influence there, too. The king himself did live in France, I think Paris, for quite a while, like pretty much most of his life. He recently moved back maybe 10 years ago. But they have quite a bit of, you know, food that derived from there and from Thailand, of course. So a fried baguette with shrimp on toast, and that's like something that you find a lot on the street. You know,
and the shrimp though is like a shrimp paste, right? It's almost like
So you chop it up. You don't want to like chop it up too much, because you still want to be able to see that chunk of shrimp in there, but then at the same time you need it to hold itself together into a form of kind of like a, you know, pate in a way.
Mm-hmm. And I love those. They're just pan fried, and then the baguette picks up a lot of oil, and they're just juicy, lovely little tasty bits.
Oh yeah, and like dripping down the side of your face, mm-hmm. and your hand. It's wonderful.
Now you're talking my language. See, that's a universal language. You could be Cambodian or you could be from Texas and still get the whole drip down the side of your face stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. See?
Any sauce?
I mean, it's definitely something that they serve alongside with a lot of things. Kind of similar to the nuoc chấm in Vietnamese culture. Sweet and sour, garlicky, spicy. They do eat a lot of spice there, a lot more than Vietnamese cuisine. Just because, you know, a lot of food that you eat on the street, sanitation isn't really high standard. So you want a lot of garlic, you want a lot of chili to kind of kill that bacteria in your body.
Well, at least they're not using bleach. That's good.
Yeah.
What kind of, you mentioned meat on a stick. What kind of, what's typical for a night market in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh?
Beef, chicken, frog legs is something that you can really get anywhere, surprisingly, because it's expensive here, right? But
right.
Frog legs on a stick is quite cheap, and you can find it at a lot of stands. That you can get it fried or grilled. It's just something that, but they use the whole body. Unlike you, we only use the legs, the meatiest part,
mm-hmm.
but they use the whole body there.
Interesting. And then
so you really have to dig into it.
Yeah. So we only have a minute, Annie. Do you marinate the frog and then put it on the grill or on the stick?
Oh, yeah. So they do heavy marinate, like with a lot of soy, fish sauce, ginger. They don't really use a lot of ginger, but a lot of lemongrass. And a lot of Thai chili, yeah.
So the whole frog, I've never had a whole frog before. I've had the legs many times, obviously, but no. Wow, that's interesting.
It's quite an image to see.
All right, Amy's going to tell us about what we got going on.
Annie, you are doing your Cambodian street food class here at the Hot Stove Society on Saturday, April 17th. Will you quickly tell us your menu?
I was going to do that crab and toast, deep fried one as an appetizer.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to do a beef salad, like marinated with lots of fish sauce. Garlic and lemongrass and lots of chili too, and you serve it over a bed of, normally you would get morning glory, but since we don't mm-hmm. have morning glories here, we are doing just lettuce and cucumber and tomatoes and maybe some watercress, and you just eat it with rice mm-hmm. and it soaks up all that sauce, and the meat you can grill it or pan sear it. Very simple, but that's how they eat there. Like lots of vegetables too.
That's going to be so delicious, Annie. So if people want to join us virtually, you can sign up for hotstovesociety.com, and you're also providing ingredient kits.
So that's April 17th at 1 o'clock.
April 17th, yes.
Annie, thanks for your time. We got to run to our next segment and to a break. So Annie Elmore, thanks for being you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Annie.
All right. Up next, I'm going to show you how to make a terrific wine and caper butter sauce, perfect for halibut or any fish, chicken, halibut, you name it, on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat from Madison Valley.
From Madison Valley. We're coming to you from the Hot Stove downtown. We are virtual now. We're getting ready. We're just starting our planning, huh, Amy, for a September reopening in person?
We are.
We're thinking that's the most likely time that things can happen. So we're starting to plan already for a September Hot Stove in-person reopening. Very exciting.
So exciting.
Wow.
Jeff, are you going to come to a class with me, do you think?
I definitely will.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right.
I mean, that's a celebration to be able to go back to having a live audience. Are you kidding?
That would be something. We're going to talk about making up quick pan sauces. Now, if you happen to be free on Friday mornings, you can join our Facebook Live watchers, and I just made one for them during the break of a caper butter sauce, Chef. And do you want to go through how you would make a caper butter sauce? And since I did it for our live watchers, why don't you tell us how you'd do it for our virtual watchers?
So I would use, after you cook your fish in your pan, your saute pan, I would remove the fish, put it on the plate, let it rest, and I would drop all the fat that and whatever stuck to that pan, I would drop that out of the pan so the pan is fairly clean.
So you would take that out because it's too dark for your sauce, right?
Yeah. And it's also, it's burnt. I mean, it's over the top. I would start with fresh butter, put some chopped shallots. I would add white wine, a super dry white wine, or even some dry vermouth, which I use, as you do, often in cooking. So I would put that in. I would add lemon rind, and I would chopped. I would put that in there. I would use fresh thyme, just chop, put it in there, and capers. And I would reduce that down slowly, or medium heat, not slowly, medium heat. Reduce it down. And then finish with a big nugget of butter at the end, mm-hmm. a nugget of butter, which we already translated to tablespoon of butter per person.
Yeah.
Put that in there. And then, you know, you take it off the heat and finish to incorporate all your butter in there. It's almost like it's an emulsion. So you don't want to boil the heck out of it. You want to make sure that it's not too hot. And then there we go. You finish seasoning with a little pepper and fresh chopped parsley at the end, and pour that right over your fish and serve it steamed potato or boiled potato on the side of a nice piece of trout or halibut or sole, and very classic and definitely delicious. And if it's for lunch, a little salad on the side.
Let's go back a little bit, making generalities on pan sauces. You know, when I was a younger cook, I was taught, like, for example, let's say we're making veal scallopini or chicken scallopini, right? And mm-hmm. you pound out your piece of veal leg and you pound it into a thin little scallopini. Same with the chicken breast. You pound it out a little bit. You don't have to. That, to me, is a big fallacy about cooking like that, is everything. I was taught everything needed to be paillard, right? Pounded out and...
Well, that was a style because it filled up the plate.
Yeah.
It filled up the plate.
Right. It filled up the plate. But also now, if you wanted to just take a nice little chicken breast you even leave the skin on, there's nothing wrong with any of all of that. So,
no.
So let's say the other thing I was taught as a young chef, which I don't do anymore, is I was always taught to dredge the scallopini in flour. And you still see a ton of recipes for that. And I do not do that at all anymore. To me, it comes off gummy and sticky and a little bit gross, because it doesn't really, but you're going into a pan for just a second because it's so thin. It doesn't have time to cook. It just ends up being this kind of floury mess.
Yeah, I was told the same thing with sweetbreads and things like this. And I don't think in 26 years at Rovers I've ever dredged my sweetbread in any flour. I've always done it crispy in brown butter, and I think it's a better texture and a better flavor for me.
Yeah, I agree with you for sure. And it's I think at the end of the day, when you're cooking, see, when you pull your veal, your sweetbread, or your chicken, or your fish off, and you've got flour on it that you've sautéed, as it's resting, it just becomes a big pile of goo. The flour does, right? And
so it
starts to soak up all the juices that are coming out of your meat. Okay, so let's say we're not doing that. Let's get rid of that out of our kitchen. It's an old wives' tale. And so we've got a nice little sear on our veal or chicken, and then we're taking it out, letting it rest. And now, for me, if I'm on a meat, like a chicken or a veal, I'm not worried about the browned butter that I sautéed in as much. Are you? Do you
Correct.
Still take it all out?
No. The only thing I would take out is if there are some burned little pieces that have fell off, you know, little protein pieces that are burned, I just remove that, but I keep the pan as is.
Right.
If it's meat. Fish is a little bit different because it cooks faster, and it also doesn't taste good when it's cooked all the way. You know, in meat, you don't see it. You add flavor to your sauce.
Mm-hmm.
In fish, you actually destroy or you disturb the flavor that you're trying to make out of your sauce.
It's kind of the pristine
flavor.
If that makes any sense. Yeah. Okay. So now we've taken our pan. We've gotten rid of the burned bits, but we've left some things in there still. Now we're going to put our chopped shallot in. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Just minced, right?
Actually, no. The first thing I do is I remove the old fat and put new fat in. So
okay.
I put fresh butter, and then I put shallots because I love to have that sweet flavor in my sauce. So I put shallots, and I sweat that a little bit, so maybe a half a minute, 30 seconds, you know.
See, that's the difference right there between you and I, is I would put a little color on those shallots. You're going to sweat them so that they're translucent, right?
Correct.
Is that
so they still
different?
Have, yeah, they still have that little... flavor of shallots left in them, not caramelized all the way. And then I would put my wine right on top of that.
Red wine, rosé, white wine, whatever you have left
wine,
in your fridge, right?
White wine. I would not do red wine. I would do white wine.
Wait. Not necessarily just for capers. I'm talking about for a pan sauce.
Oh, for a pan sauce. Well, you could use red wine. Yes, absolutely.
You could use whatever,
white.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Even rosé, if you have rosé,
right.
It's like white wine.
And
you can use that.
Do you ever add a little stock to it? Like a little...
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's very rare that I don't have. In my freezer, I have little nuggets, of reduced veal stock, and it's easy to take out of the freezer, unwrap, and pop in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
And as it cooks down, you know, when the reduction of the wine is happening, you put that nugget in there.
I'm telling that's a game changer when you add stuff like that.
Oh yeah, I mean,
for a man who refuses to eat at McDonald's, you eat a lot of nuggets.
Yeah, but mine are good.
Okay, so we've got our nuggets of stock. We've got our wine. We're reducing. We've got our shallot in there. We're reducing. To me now, after it's reduced, now is when I add my lemon or my herbs, because I don't like to cook those out at all.
Right, right. Or not too much. You want to cook the lemon rind. You want to cook a little bit.
Little bit, yeah.
But you don't want to cook the capers. You have no need to cook the capers. You just want to warm them up.
Right. What about if you're adding sautéed mushrooms? You add those back at this point, right?
Correct. I would have sautéed my mushroom on the side and then add them back in.
Yeah.
And now all the flavor is there. All the texture you're looking for is there. And then finish with, of course, the most bravest thing of the world is a big nugget of butter.
And so you get that herbs.
Unctuous silkiness and then all the fresh herbs.
And now's the time to take a little spoon, give it a taste so that you can season your sauce at this point kind of correctly, right?
Yeah, don't put salt in your sauce any time before the end because you're going to be reducing down, which is going to double up on the strength of your salt. Mm-hmm. And even your pepper is going to be, accentuated. So just wait till the end to season your sauce correctly. It's called taste, season to taste.
Right, but you've also salt and peppered your protein before you sautéed it.
Correct. Yeah, so there's still leftover of that in the pan.
Too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the capers are very salty, because of the brine and everything. Mm-hmm. So you want to be careful reducing that down, not to put salt beforehand.
At that point, you want to put your nugget of butter in. If your butter is super cold or too super big, you got to cut it down into smaller pieces. And at this point, you really don't want to boil the sauce anymore. Once you start adding your butter, you want to stir it in, emulsify your sauce, and then turn your heat off on the burner and just let the sauce stay warm. But if you boil your sauce at this point, you'll break the butter. Depending on how much you're using, you'll break the butter right out of it. So it'll become like an oil film and your base sauce instead of having an emulsification sauce.
And if you're prepping ahead, just stop. Don't do the butter at the end until the last minute, meaning that you can reduce your sauce. You can have your stock ready, all your stuff we just talked about on a stove. But don't finish it with the butter until you need to eat it. So, you're having your appetizer, you stand up, and then you warm up your protein, and then you finish your butter in your sauce and put that on top of your protein.
Sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. Sounds delicious. Stay with us. We're going to jump into hoisin sauce. What the heck is it? How do you make it? How do you use it? When we come back on Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. You're jumping right back in with us, Chef Terry and I, into the Hot Stove Society radio show. We have one more full hour. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rocciaro, the chef in the hat.
In this hour, we're going to chat about our favorite, one of our favorite condiments, maybe not Terry's, but certainly mine, hoisin sauce, a typical sauce of China. I always kind of consider it the ketchup of China. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Masa Master Chef Bridget Chartis is going to be here to talk about making masa. And farmer-in-chief, my wife, Jackie Cross, is going to be here from Prosser Farm to tell us where she's at in her spring garden. We try to have her in every couple of months to kind of give us a progress report and maybe what you should be looking for in your gardens here in the west side. We probably get a little bit of a jump on you on the east side of the mountains where it's a little bit hotter, a little bit more intense sunshine. So we're going to see where that is. I know she's busy planting the greenhouses and getting the hoop houses up and ready to go to plant chards and kales and all sorts of spring greens. And lastly, we're going to play our Food for Thought, Rub with Love, Tasty Trivia. And I feel like, I'm not sure if Bridget or Jackie's going to join us for that, Amy.
Jackie's
going to join us for that. And we're going to try and crush her like the sweet pea that she is. Okay, let's talk hoisin sauce. Chef, what's your vision of hoisin sauce? What do you know about it? Because I don't think like into it like the way I am.
No, I'm not into it as much as you are. And I often regret not to use it as much as I could possibly use it, especially when I start pulling the grill out, wanted to do some nice grilling of a barbecue ribs or, stuff like that. That's when I usually go, oh, I got that bottle of hoisin. I need to use that in my marinade. Maybe add a little salt. The only thing I don't necessarily care for the hoisin is it's very sweet.
Oh, it's very sweet. The number one ingredient the one that I like is sugar.
Yeah. So that's the first ingredient. It's a bit sweet. So I'm a big fan of mixing it with some very nice soy sauce, you know, like added some ingredients that are going to vinegar, things are going to perk up and cut down on that sweetness, on that sugar.
Okay.
It doesn't cut down on the sugar. It just cuts down on the sweetness.
Right.
And that's where I like to use oyster, basically. I'm not a big fan of oyster just by itself. It has a few places to go with. Like you said earlier, you know, if you get a
mushu pork, Peking
duck.
Yeah,
mushu pork.
Yeah.
I mean, we're used to having it in mushu pork, but I would love to change a little bit of that sauce to make mushu pork even a bit better of a sauce.
Well, hoisin sauce, in case you've never had it, H-O-I-S-I-N, hoisin sauce. And Amy's going to put a picture on our Facebook page to show you the brand that I buy the most. I've been buying this brand for 42 years. It was one of the first sauces that I found when I first moved to Seattle, when I was roaming around Chinatown and all the little groceries. Somebody turned me on to this sauce, and I've been buying it ever since. It's called Kunchun, K-O-O-N. And then the capital, C-H-U-N. Kunchun is a sauce factory in China. They make all kinds of sauces. This is the one that I have latched onto. It's a distinctive blue and yellow jar and lid and stuff. It's always been my favorite. Stan at Huayang Grocery, he had that one whisker that would come down all the way down around his chin. He was the coolest dude. And it's now where the Wing Luke Museum is. You can see a little bit of Stan's grocery in there in Wing Luke. They kept a little his counter and stuff like that. It's super cool. Anyway, so this particular hoisin sauce, the ingredients are sugar, soybean paste. And so what's soybean paste? You know, when I make my own hoisin, I use miso. I use a fermented miso as my base. That's soybean paste. There's all kinds out there, but that's what I use when I make my own homemade miso or hoisin. Also, what's in this particular one is rice vinegar, dehydrated garlic, sesame seed oil, salted chili. So that's just a dried chili of some sort, salt and spices. They have taken the MSG out of this. This used to always have MSG. And so as with many sauces, Chinese sauces, like our favorite crispy chilies, Terry, has plenty of MSG. You can taste it when you take a big spoonful of it. But this one does not have MSG anymore, so it's a fairly natural sauce. And when I was playing with this, with my own sauce line for Rub With Love, I had to make my own because, you know, Whole Foods and places like that at the time wouldn't let any sort of what they call dirty sauces in. So there was a list of ingredients, preservatives and things like that they just wouldn't let in their store. And so we tried to make our teriyaki sauce, for example, with clean soy sauce and clean vinegars and all the things that you have to do in order to keep your label appropriate for Whole Foods, because that was the market we were trying to get into. When I opened Dahlia 32 years ago, on the menu, at the bottom of the menu, even with all my Italian stuff that I loved and stuff, I had a Chinatown barbecue section on the menu. And I would do it, my Chinatown barbecue, I would do it with a lup chong fried rice with pickled radish. And I would brown rice, lots of green onion, garlic and ginger, lup chong, which is a sweet Chinese sausage, and pickled radish, which is big daikon radish with yellow number 5 dye in there. And it was so good. I love that. And then I would serve it with a hoisin barbecued food. So I did. I made a sauce that I used on all the different things. I had hoisin barbecued duck or salmon or chicken or steak. And that was your choices to go on the fried rice. I simply took the hoisin as the base, this little jar right here as my base. And then I did what you said, Chef. I just doctored it up, right? I added lots more vinegar. I reduced orange juice, so I had that acid. I had ginger and garlic. And I just kind of made my own star anise, lots of star anise. Right. I made my own version of a Chinese barbecue sauce out of it. To this day, I mean, that recipe is in Seattle Kitchen, my first book. But to this day, I still make ribs and I still make barbecue salmon in exactly the same way all these years later. And I just love this sauce.
Well, I think it's a great base. I agree with you that it's a definitely a good foundation. It's just, to me, I think that I'm not happy with just that. I want more. I want to add more to it. And I think it's the perfect way to do it. It's add some acids, add some, definitely don't add any sweetness, but acids, herbs, paste of herbs, like if you were like basil, if you were doing a basil pesto, you could, without the cheese, you could add that to like a basil puree, lemon, add that to the oyster, and you'd have something much different of a sauce at the end to put on top of your fish at the end.
Yeah.
So
back in 1978, I worked with a chef named Rusty Trailer, and that he's the guy who turned me on the hoisin sauce, and I've been using it ever since.
Good for you, man. That's you've been doing Asian food for a long time.
I've been doing Asian inspired food.
Yeah.
For quite a long time. You're absolutely right. Okay, up next we've got Bridget Charters here. You know her from the Hot Stove Society, one of our chief presenters here. And we're going to talk masa. We go from hoisin sauce to masa. We were in Cambodian New Year to fresh halibut. We cover everything on this show.
Caper butter to hoisin.
That's right. We'll be right back at the Hot Stove Society Show, Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. And we're back. You're having fun here at the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rothero, the chef in the hat.
And chef, we are going to go from hoisin sauce basics to masa masters. So Chef Bridget is here, one of the instructors here at the Hot Stove Society. And Bridget, you do classes here all the time called masa masters. So tell us what that is and what can somebody do at home to become a masa master? Confidence.
Confidence in the kitchen, as you say. Mm-hmm. Just start working with stuff. I mean, masa is a flour that's very common. It is the flour of choice down in Mexico, and it's amazing. It's delicious.
Oh, no pun intended.
I know.
Amazing.
It's delicious. And masa, I mean, you and Tom and I have talked about it, teaching classes here. What we know are those sacks of masa that you get in the grocery store.
Maseca
brand.
General Mills.
Correct. And it's this giant GMO, that produces this masa. And it's like one strain of corn. It's kind of like the dilemma that is happening with the flour, the wheat flour industry. Mm-hmm. Same thing. It's like mono, and there's no biodiversity. There's no amazing products. So I got to know.
But let's go back to that. Let's stay on that for 1 second. Why is that? The government of Mexico subsidizes tortillas. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So every neighborhood's got a little tortilla factory. And they have to charge what the government says they can charge for the tortillas. So there's not a real impetus to change to use more expensive corn in their tortillas, right? Because it's essentially a subsidized national product.
Right, unless you're in remote places, not remote, but if you're in places like Oaxaca or in small villages where they grow those corn, they just do it because they love it and it tastes good. Mm-hmm. But what we're exposed to up in America is the big commodity because that's what's provided to us. And I didn't really understand until years ago. I was at the Aspen Wine and Food Festival. It was kind of one of my first years, Monty. Caseberg had brought me on, and Rick Bayless was one of our presenters, and he had requested fresh masa. There we were in Aspen, Colorado, and Rick Bayless is there. I hadn't met him. It was my first time, and it was like, oh, this is great. This is like 2000.
So Rick Bayless from Public TV, right?
Rick Bayless, the Mexican television chef on PBS, and he's got numerous restaurants in Chicago and countless books. I mean, he's an amazing guy. And anyway, persnickety and particular, and he wanted fresh masa, and so one of our team was supposed to go down valley and pick up fresh masa from one of the local Mexican ladies. And anyway, they didn't have any. They were out, so they just told Rick, well, we don't have any. And the night before, I had been prepping his demo, and I just went ahead and took the dry stuff and made some masa. Anyway, he freaked out. We had to peel him off the ceiling. He was pissed. And it was just like, and so I kind of quietly slid this bowl over and set it in front of him. And he was like, well, what's this? And somebody was like, well, that's masa, And he's like, okay, this will be fine. But where'd this come from? And I was like, I made it from the dry. It's been sitting overnight. So it worked out well. So what the reality is that you guys can buy the masa flour and start working with it. What it is corn. Mm-hmm. And there are five varietals of corn, and this is the larger kind of dense style corn. There's feed corn, there's the corn, the sweet corn that we eat, and the those corn kernels are soaked in, and Tom, you were doing this at Cantina Lania, right? The corn kernels
are nixtamalized.
Nixtamalized, yeah, with a little calcium chloride, or back in the old days, they used a hardwood ash from the fireplace. Boil the corn, let it sit overnight after it's boiled, and you check the corn kernels, and then you grind them, and boom, you have masa. Okay. And that's what Rick serves, and that's what Tom served at Cantina.
So what do you have in front of you there today?
So I got turned on to, I don't know, I was reading something, blog, Rick Bayless did, and it's Masienda, M-A-S-I-E-N-D-A.
That's who we were buying our corn from at Cantina.
That's what Amy said, yeah. And I was like, you know, I had started at Hot Stove when you guys were just launching Cantina Lania, so I didn't know. And so I've developed a relationship with these folks, and I now use only this corn masa. It's organic. It's biodiverse. There's blue, there's white, and they also have a red masa.
I know, it's heirloom, right? So it's original strains
delicious.
Of corn that a lot of Mexican farmers just won't get paid enough to grow anymore.
Right.
The yield isn't there.
Yeah, and once you make the dough, it's just flour, this masa flour and water. That's it. And you just need to get it to the proper consistency and then learn to make these different things. And tamales are one. You guys are doing something on the dock, right?
Tell us about your masa master's class, because when I was making masa over at the farm with Carmine, who works at the farm, she hydrates her masa much more than I ever did. And I really like, because when she then makes her tortillas and puts them in her little steam jacket, they really do steam. There's much more water in there than mine were, and mine were just too dry.
Right.
I was making them too dry.
It's true, and that's like it's imperative that they're as wet as possible to the point where you can't even handle them. And so in the Masa Masters class, I teach people to make tortillas, and we've been doing it virtually, and I just use a griddle, a Lodge griddle, to make my tortillas on. And it's amazing. Tortillas are like French pastry crust. You've got those French chefs that can make that beautiful pastry paper thin. Same with tortillas. And when you have those thin ones, it blows your mind. Mm-hmm. You know,
they're so good. I love them with just salt and butter.
Oh, it's the best.
But whatever. And so when you make a tortilla, so that's one thing that you can do with a tortilla. But when you make it, you have the tortilla press, and you can do it a little bit thicker and make a gordito, right?
Yeah.
That's the one thing when I was teaching your class, I just love those things.
Yeah, they're so good.
I made a little bean paste, you know, 50% bean, 50% cheese, put it in between two very thick tortillas, raw masa tortillas,
right.
And then griddled that until it was cooked and kind of crusty golden.
And is that
brown.
Enough to cook it?
Yeah. Well, you go slow. You go slow on the griddle, and it just cooks, and the cheese melts, and the tortillas, you keep turning them until you can kind of tell. And in Central America, they're called pupusas. In Mexico, they're called gorditas, and they're delicious. You can put a little salad on them. You know, the food is very simple down in Mexico, but the flavor is just mind-boggling. It's so delicious.
That's what I loved about the gordito is that, unlike a taco, which for me, I don't like to stuff tacos. I like to eat the mix and kind of eat the tortilla on the side. The gordito was the perfect base for a big salad right on top, that hot, creamy, chewy mixture on the bottom, just the perfect base for a nice little summer salad.
Right, and it, like all cooking, like we just said, confidence in the kitchen. You just got to do it more and do it and do it. And the more you do it, the better you get. And
practice makes perfect.
Yeah, we've done classes. We added it to one of our events things. We were doing masa, and I had this couple up on the front counter. All they did was make tortillas, and they kind of freaked out. But by the end of it, they had a beautiful stack, like crepes, beautiful stack of tortillas, and everybody loved them, you know.
And they'll make them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
They always will have that experience. Once you start to make things like that, you'll always have that experience. Amy, when is our next Masa Masters class?
We have a couple of them coming up in May.
Yay.
So you're doing a dinner, and then are you doing Cinco de Mayo?
Cinco de Drinko.
Oh, yeah. That's what she calls it. So that's at hotstovesociety.com.
Yes.
But if you're hungry for tamales, we also have a pop-up on March 30th where we're doing tamales rojos, veggie tamales, red beans, or red rice and beans, and of course, hibiscus margaritas.
Oh, absolutely, man.
And those are, I'm coming those for that. Are Yolandas,
those
right?
Those are Yolandas. And tamales. We tasted them a couple weeks ago, and they're so good.
Oh.
All right. Up next, it's Prosser Farm Report with Jack Cross on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society, featuring the chef and chapeau from Madison Valley, Chef Thierry Rotrou. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
I gave you that big build-up, and that's all I got. I'm Tom Douglas, chef owner of several restaurants here in Seattle, including the Serious Takeout in Ballard, 52nd and 14th Northwest, and, of course, Serious Pie downtown, and C-Town Etta's restaurant down there in the north end area of the Pike Place Market. Chef Bridget Chardish is joining us, and of course, Jackie Cross is going to join us from Prosser Farm to give us the Spring Farm Report. Since we last spoke to her, spring has sprung, and she has left me again for the wilds of Prosser, Washington, to seed the greenhouses and bring home the bacon, so to speak.
And eat bring home amazing, the right?
I'm not growing any bacon.
Bring home the peas.
Peas. You would, and eating you would really good very, Mexican food.
You could be a very wealthy woman growing bacon.
I know. It would be great if I could grow bacon.
So, Jack, tell us what's going on out in Prosser and the kind of where, what stage you are with the vegetables that people are going to be eating in our restaurants in just a month or two.
A month or so. Absolutely. It is absolutely spring here. It's crazy. Gorgeous, beautiful day today, and things are so much stuff going on. It's very busy around here. We've got the greenhouse growing, all of the peppers and our tomatoes and some flowers and a few other eggplants and a couple other things are all seeded and in the greenhouse. All of our earlier stuff, mustard, lettuce, kale, chard, that we grew all the greens earlier in the greenhouse, they've all moved out into the cold frames. So they stay out there to harden off for the next day or two, and then they will get planted at the beginning of next week into the ground, which would be great. And then within 3 weeks or so, we should be able to start picking from them, which is terrific.
Into the regular, house, Jackie, into the regular ground?
Yeah.
Really?
Into the regular ground. We got water today. This is the earliest water that we've gotten since I've been farming in 10 years. I mean, we live in an area where we have to wait for the irrigation to be turned on. The irrigation canals to be turned on. And so normally we get water mid-April. Sometimes it's been as long as late April. But we've had so much snowpack in the mountains this year that they've turned the water on, and we're just starting up our irrigation today, which is amazing. And that's so what I've been doing all morning is priming the pump and laying out the irrigation line.
So you're not worried about frost?
With the greens that we have, no, they're going to be hardy enough that they can take that kind of cold weather. It is getting dipping down into 32 to 30 in the mornings, but it doesn't last very long. It it cools down and then bounces back pretty quickly. The
it's hard to believe.
Orchards around here are very worried.
I bet they are, yeah.
It's hard to believe you would need rain. You would need water this time of year because – I'll tell you one thing, in my garden, we don't need water.
No, it's desert over there, year-round.
Yeah, it's desert. And once you put in the seedlings and stuff like that, then or the little transplants, they really do need to get watered in well. And walking up and down the lines with your handheld watering wand is not that fun, when you have like 10 100-foot rows, so it takes a long time. The peas are already in the ground, which is awesome. They should be popping up within a couple of days. And then a lot of things that we put in the ground last fall are still doing really well. We have rhubarb is coming up. Strawberries are coming up. Our peas are in the ground. The herbs are just jumping out of the ground. I'll be able to harvest some tarragon and some thyme and some chives this week, which will be great. And then we also have vegetables in our hoop house, which overwintered in there. So we still have a really good supply of chard and kale and cabbage right now. And that is just starting to bolt, which is like perfect timing because I can pick heavy this week and then I'll let the rest of it go to Rob and pick the Rob next week and then we'll pull it out. And by that point, our other ones that we put, our seedlings that we put into the ground should be able to take over.
That's amazing. Hey, Jackie, this is Bridget. I had a question on your kale. So those little shoots with the little flowers on top, that's what you call rob with the leaves?
Yeah.
I mean, I just pick them off and eat them. But so I cut 6 inches of that? Cause everything...
I would cut, you want it to be pretty tender because you want it to cook pretty quickly. So, yeah, down 4 to 6 inches.
Does it bush out from then?
Pardon?
Does it bush out?
That will bush out and make more rob shoots. I mean, it's going to flower. It's trying to reproduce itself. So that's its job right now. Once it starts going to flower like that, you start losing the production on leaves and stuff that you normally would. So, yeah, you can pinch it off the top. You'll get a few more shoots to the side. Once you get, a couple of picks off the rob, they're pretty much finished at that point.
That's amazing.
But they're delicious. I love that, all that rob.
And that's all of your kale and chard from last year that you had in the fall?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yep, put it in last fall, and that did great. And the hoop house, I mean, it's an unheated hoop house, so, it slows down a lot during the wintertime, but it kept on going. And now it's just, jumping out of the ground. It's great.
Oh, nice.
So the hoop house runs, if I had to guess, and tell me if I'm wrong, Jack, 20 degrees warmer than it does outside, just outside the hoop house. And that's just solar.
And that's just solar, just by having the sun. And it's protected from the wind. We get a lot of wind over here, and that can really dump the temperature down a bit, when those winds come through and stuff. So being protected from that really does give it an advantage to be able to survive over the winter.
Is there one new vegetable you're excited about coming into the ground this year?
I'm going to plant some okra again, which I love because the plants are so friggin' beautiful. I like them more for how they look.
It's Tom's favorite vegetable, right?
Tom's favorite vegetable. He loves that, along with beets. I can't get enough.
Yeah,
beets,
exactly.
And okra,
but Tom probably hasn't had them when they're teeny, those little inch and a half okras where they just
so
get
good.
Sauteed. They're like peas. Have you had those?
You know what the bane of a farmer's existence is?
People like you.
No, teeny vegetables that they have to try.
I know.
That's why she doesn't plant cherry, those sweet 100 cherry tomatoes anymore, any of that stuff. They're just hard to pick.
They're so hard. That's so labor intensive to pick those. It's crazy.
Jerry, tell Jackie about that tuber that you brought on earlier as your taste of the week, and maybe she'll grow some of those for you.
So it's called Yukon. So it's Yukon. Y-U-C-O-N. And
I know them.
Oh, man, this is delicious.
Yeah, it's Peruvian tubers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They're pretty delicious.
So sweet and delicious and beautiful in fruit salad or in just regular salad because it's got a nice sweetness to it. Very healthy for you. Huge amount of healthy components to that tuber. And just beautiful all around. Stays nice and dry in the cellar for weeks, months.
So, Jackie, can I ask a question? Does Terry's got one that he's holding right now. If you were to go to, say, a South American grocery store and get some of those, can you just cut those into chunks and plant the chunks? Is that what a seed tuber is?
I think these are more of a corm than a tuber, but I'm not totally
sure. So the way this plant, these big tuber are picked out of the ground below, they're the deepest part. What's on top of that is a bunch of little growth, shallot size, smaller tuber, which is the part of the plant. You want to keep that part of the plant and break it down and then replant that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
It's more of a dividing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so the whole top of the plant, when you start digging gently around the base of the plant, the first thing you're going to find is all those little tuber first, and then underneath or next to it is those big giant one. The big one is the one you eat. The small one is the one you use to replant.
To replant.
And then also, it grows up to 6 to 8 feet tall, and the leaves are perfectly edible. They're delicious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just.
Did you
excited.
Grow it last year?
No, somebody just gave me one. One my manager Katie at Luke Tram. She gave me a couple of them because she works in this garden and community garden and they've grown that as a sample And man, mm-hmm. it is surprisingly, it's so nice to discover something new.
Completely new, yeah.
That you don't know, and that tastes actually really delicious.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jack, we have about 30 seconds. Let's wrap up the farm report. Anything else?
Fruit trees are just getting ready to burst. Their buds are all swelling. You can see the color on them. So fingers crossed we don't get too cold of a weather over the next week or so, because they're really going to go to town. But looking at the forecast, it looks great. I'm excited for the season. This is the best time of year because everything is possible and everything looks fabulous.
I know. And none of the drama, none of the pestilence.
None of the drama.
And you know, all that.
There's no bugs. There's no disease. There's no wind. There's no hurricanes, yeah. Whatever.
Good.
All right. Great. This is always the most, you're right. This is the time when everyone's like spring baseball. So everyone's in first place. And then by June, you're in tears. Jackie's going to stay with us. She's going to team up with Bridget, I understand, Bridget Charters.
Yep.
To take on Chef Terry and I in our Rub with Love Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Right back on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
We're going to jump right into our Rub with Love Tasty Trivia Challenge. Rub with Love is my own brand. It's tasty, handcrafted, versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. Look for Rub with Love products in your local grocery store, online, in butcher shops, Wajamaya, Bartels. I mean, we sell them all over the place, and they're certainly delicious. And if all else fails, just go to tomdouglas.com/shop, and you can get your Rub with Love products there. We'll mail them to you. Amy, today's lucky winner, who?
I'm going to pick Chris Hay, who is our Facebook Live listener, who had the question about hosting a chef competition.
Ah.
So we're going to give her a prize.
Nice. Okay. And she can give it away at the competition,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
What's That's the prize?
Awesome. Okay, the prize today is, of course, a halibut theme. We're going to do seafood rub, which is great on all white fish, especially halibut. Ginger pineapple teriyaki glazed over halibut on the grill or mm-hmm. in the oven. And your trick, pork rub on halibut for fish tacos.
Lovely.
Sounds
I'm going to throw one more rub in there because I really like our Tokyo rub.
Mm.
Like when you're searing the fish or when you're grilling the fish with the rub on it and then finish with the teriyaki sauce. It's a great combination.
Delicious.
So
yum.
There'll be one extra rub in there.
Okay.
You want to tell us the rules of the game, maybe?
Okay. So, Bridget and Jackie, you are teaming up today. You are going to play against Tom and Thierry. I'm going to ask each of you 5 questions, and the loser is paying for shipping to Kay.
Well, and since don't Tom's laugh, Bridget. It's $10.
Okay. All right, Jackie, let's take him down.
All right, I'm going to start with Thierry first, and then we'll go to All right. the ladies. All right, Thierry.
True, I'm ready.
Okay, you're ready. True or false? Fettuccine Primavera was created in the USA.
True.
You're correct. An antioxidant in this food helps digestion, kills bacteria, and reduces risk of blood clots. A, molasses, B, hot peppers, C, chocolate, or D, honey?
Chocolate.
Boy.
I'm sorry, that is incorrect. It is hot peppers. Okay, a Spanish omelet is also known as what?
A torta.
You are correct.
So what is a Spanish omelet, chef?
Onions and potatoes.
Yes, it is.
Very simple. Lots of olive oil, and it's delicious.
You see it in every tapas bar in the Spain. So.
And eggs.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, of course.
It's like
yes.
Thick, heavy Very frittata, good, potato frittata.
We're doing good. 2 out of 3 so far, Thierry. Next question. How can we convert white sugar into brown sugar?
Ooh. Do you convert white sugar into brown sugar? Just cook it down.
I was going to say, caramelize it. No, what's
that? By adding molasses.
Yeah, you just add a little molasses to it.
I should know that.
Because that molasses is sugar. Yeah, it's the extract, right? So.
Okay, last question. What is the topping on cottage pie?
Oh, my God. Is cottage pie made with cottage cheese?
No, it's. No. I would say it's either slate or asphalt shingles.
That sounds about right.
No,
I go with slates.
Terry, you said this. You told me how to make ground beef this way.
Mashed potato.
You are correct.
Crumb. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was a nice wingman.
See how it is. The boys are helping each other out.
Can you tell me, is that what it's called? It's called cottage?
Know, it depends on what part of the world you're in. It's shepherd's pie, cottage pie.
Oh, okay, okay.
If I can jump in, shepherd's pie is normally made with lamb, and cottage pie is normally made with beef.
Wow.
Okay.
I think
so. It's just like hachis parmentier is what we call it in France.
You have 3 out of 5 ladies. You need to beat
Thank
that.
You, Tom.
What classic cocktail consists of gin, lime juice, and a lime wedge garnish?
Gimlet.
Yay! Okay. In preparing mushrooms for cooking, you should A, wash under running water and brush lightly, B, blanch and drain, C, whirl in a salad spinner, or D, never wash them because they absorb liquids.
Well, this is a trick question, Jackie.
I know. I'm not sure about this
What kind of mushrooms? This is vague.
Mushrooms. Mushrooms are mushrooms.
I normally just brush them and don't wash them. I don't know if
I agree.
That's the correct way.
Well, the correct answer is A, wash under running water and brush lightly. So
I think that's good. Yes.
Yeah,
come on, she said.
No.
You were getting a half of a point.
All right. Half a point's good.
My God. Fair enough.
That is nonsense.
Okay. What is Hungary's national dish? A, stroganoff, B, spätzle, or C, goulash?
It's either A or C.
Yeah, I think goulash, don't you? I don't know.
Yes, I agree.
You are correct.
Yay!
Okay, although famously...
Amy is never this happy when I get something correct.
It's girl power. Whatever, me too.
Okay, although famously grown in Australia, which fruit is also known as the Chinese gooseberry?
I believe that's
kiwi,
yeah.
Yay! You are correct. Okay, last question. Which food has the highest percentage of water content?
So which food would it be? Something like, okay, Jackie, let's discuss this. Watermelon.
Highest percentage of water.
Could be mushrooms. Could be strawberries.
Grapes.
Highest percentage by weight? Yep. Yes.
You know, it's only a two-hour show,
Bridget.
Just so you know.
Should we guess? I'll say strawberries. No, she's wincing.
No, I'm
she's
so
wincing.
Sorry. The correct answer is cucumber.
Yeah, I was going to say cucumber.
Oh, whatever, Terry. Yeah. Oh, I was going to say that.
You would think a farmer would know that, huh, Terry?
Whoa. Okay. Dang it. You are still in the lead with 3.5 out of 5 points.
Okay.
All right, Tom.
All right, Tom.
Whatever, Tom.
Tom, they're all waiting. They're all waiting.
I know.
All right. When eyeing red wine, what does a purplish tint mean?
Youngest. It correct. Gets a little brown when it gets older.
You are correct, Tom.
There's a tear. There's a tear coming out of her eye right now.
What is the difference between a fruit cobbler and a fruit crumble?
A cobbler has a biscuit on top.
You are correct. What pastry is used to make a beef Wellington?
Puff pastry.
Oh, my
like
God.
Like that one.
All right, you're correct.
Like
so
that one.
You have 3
What else
out of
is
5.
In a beef Wellington?
Mushroom.
Beef.
Yes, I like a little mushroom duck cell.
Mm-hmm. Ham.
No.
A little foie gras.
Okay, keep going.
Okay. Which chili is considered to be the hottest chili in the world?
I couldn't tell you that all the names. The ghost chili is what I think of, but...
You're correct.
Oh, man.
I didn't know you wanted a particular name for that.
Dang it.
Okay, so you have 4 out of 5.
He has to give the scientific name, Amy. What's the scientific name?
Yeah, exactly. What's the Latin name?
Yeah.
That sounds to be more difficult.
What is the number?
Which is an Indian dish, but the national dish of England?
An Indian dish, but the national dish of England. And it's not as broad as just saying curry.
No.
Right? So it's a... It's an Indian dish, but the national dish of England.
Ooh. It's got to be chicken something, right?
When I'm over there, I have chicken masala probably the most.
You are correct.
Oh my God.
And that is 5 out of 5.
What is that?
Oh, my Woo. God.
Jerry,
Terry, Chef Terry, how many was that?
5 out of 5,
Ooh,
Tom.
I guess... Who's paying for shipping?
Oh, Terry, you are paying for shipping.
I'm paying for shipping.
If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Amy Richardson, sound and production by Sean McFadden. and our sound and editing by Don. Don't call me Del Torre. Also, remember, if you missed any episode of our Hot Stove Society show on Cairo, you can listen via podcast. Just go to your favorite podcast app and tune in there.
Thank you for listening, and have a fabulous weekend.